Welcome to the podcast, Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path, and I'm your host, Mike Allen. We often hear of Danbury being the Hat City, Meriden the Silver City, and Waterbury the Brass City. Well, did you know that Plymouth and Bristol combined were the clock cities? Yes, the biggest clock producers in the United States. It's where Eli Terry and Seth Thomas got their starts. Our guest today is going to be able to tell us all about this, Patty Philippon. She's the executive director of the American Clock and Watch Museum in Bristol. And first, this week's trivia question. Some monumental global decisions have been made at a structure in Washington, D.C., a structure that Connecticut played a critical role in developing. What is that structure? We'll stick around after the main program for the answer, because then you'll know what the topic is for next week's show. Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path is brought to you by our sponsor, Yale New Haven Health. Yale New Haven Hospital was the very first hospital in Connecticut. They opened their doors 200 years ago and later introduced the entire country to the use of penicillin and chemotherapy. Today, some of the brightest minds in medicine choose to work there, and it's the primary teaching hospital for the prestigious Yale School of Medicine. For more information, log on to ynhhs.org. That's ynhhs.org. How long is this podcast? Well, the devices used to produce it have incredibly detailed timing mechanisms, in fact, all the way down to a hundredth of a second. Well, we don't need to be that specific with the timing, but we do generally try to keep all the episodes to about 20 minutes. Well, we can thank the entrepreneurs and craftsmen and craftswomen who lived in the area around Plymouth and Bristol, Connecticut, for giving us the ability to keep track of time. Yes, those adjacent towns formed what we now know as the clock-making capital of the United States in the 1700s, the 1800s, and even part of the 1900s. It was here that the master of them all, Eli Terry, built his first factory. And that's where he taught the likes of a guy named Seth Thomas how to build a clock. Well, like many other technologies in those days, it didn't actually originate here. It came from England. But when the technology did make its way over to the newly settled North America in the 1700s, the technology landed in eastern Connecticut and eventually became nestled in the Plymouth-Bristol region. Now, Eli Terry was not only famous for making clocks. He was actually the first person in the U.S. to figure out how to mass-produce parts that were actually interchangeable. So that means that if something broke in a device that you had bought, instead of buying a whole new device, you could just replace a part. Well, for expensive clocks, that was critical, and of course that played over into other industries as well. He's also responsible for developing so-called shelf clocks. Now, those could fit on a shelf, and before Eli Terry did that, your only option for a clock were those hugely expensive, tall grandfather clocks. Today we're going to be joined by Patty Philippon. She's the executive director of the American Clock and Watch Museum in Bristol. Now, Patty's going to use the word movements a lot in this discussion on clocks, and when she does, she's referring to all of the gears that come together inside a clock or a watch to make the entire mechanism move. Tell me about the history of it, because I think that's important for people to understand.
People have been using various kinds of devices to tell time for as long as humanity has been there. And they start by telling time using the natural resources that they have. When the sun comes up, when the sun goes down, the different seasons, especially here in New England, where we have four very distinct seasons, which is not what they have everywhere. They live their lives by when the sun comes up, especially in rural and agrarian societies. People wake up with the sun and do their work, and when it sets, you go to sleep. They start slowly. You see people telling time with water clocks. People start telling time through sand glasses, and you have sand glasses that tell different amounts of time, 10 minutes, half an hour. Hourglasses is what I think people most commonly think of as the sand goes through for about an hour. You have candles that people use. As the candle is lit and as the wax melts down, you can have different increments by how far the candle melts. So people have been very adaptive to learning how to measure time and how time is important to them.
Now, some people may not actually like the fact that we have clocks because what it's kind of done is control us now because everything's done by the clock.
Absolutely. You know, nowadays, we kind of take for granted that we know exactly what time it is, not just down to the minute, but down to the second or the millisecond. And it controls people's lives. It made huge changes in industry when people went from working where they might be doing piecemeal work and they worked on their own times to having to go into the office or go into a factory and work on someone else's schedule. And that made a huge change to people's lives.
And it's funny how you showed me around the museum and all the different punch clocks they have. And what are we talking about now but work from home and people are on their own clock?
Right. It kind of went back to how things had been before. And now people are questioning wanting to go back into the office and working on somebody else's schedule again.
Exactly. When you look at almost how fate brought together Eli Terry and the gentleman that he learned the clockmaking industry from, let's talk about this because the United States didn't invent clockmaking. That came from Europe. But there was a gentleman that came from Europe just about the time that the famous Eli Terry, who we're here to talk about today, that about the time he was born, this other gentleman came from England and came to Norwich. And tell me about this guy.
So Thomas Harland is the name of the clockmaker. As you said, he came from England and he came to the United States and he knew clockmaking. He was a master clockmaker and he would then teach apprentices. So his timepieces that he would make the movement. They were brass movements, but they would be finished by hand and then assembled by hand. And he would put them together. Typically, you could make 12 to 20 movements in a year. He did some engravings on the dials that went with the clock movements, but then you would have to have somebody else to hire to make the cases for them. So these are tall clocks, or what we call today grandfather clocks. And he had an apprentice who he could then teach the trade to, and that was Daniel Burnap. And Daniel Burnap, after learning his trade from Harland, moved to the South Windsor area and continued on in the trade and making his clocks. And he taught Eli Terry, and Eli Terry started apprenticing to Daniel Burnap around age about 14.
So we know that now Eli Terry is, you know, he's young, he's 14 years old, and this is the time when you got an apprenticeship in those days, and he happens to hook up with this guy, Burnham, who's come over now from Norwich, and he just absorbs the entire clock-making business, and by 21, he says, I'm going out on my own.
So he, at that point, is making these tall clocks or grandfather clocks. These are the movements that he's been trained to make. They were very labor intensive. You know, you're making 12 to 20 in a year. And he wanted to find a way to make them more accessible, to be able to make more of them. He starts to develop different kinds of technologies to start mass producing some of the parts. And he gets to a point where he can make about 200 movements a year. And that's still a huge jump from making 12 to making 200. He's trained to do things with brass movements. He starts looking at the wooden works and some of the crude wooden works movements that are being made by the Cheneys, who are from East Hartford, and gets the idea of being able to use wood and hardwoods to make some of the clock movements, because in this area, the natural resources are here to have it. In Bristol, where we are now, it was called the West Woods of Farmington originally before it became incorporated as Bristol. This is an area that's got a lot of these hardwoods that they could use. So he starts trying to figure out how to make a wooden works clock movement. And he and two other gentlemen, who are Silas Hoadley and Seth Thomas, work together to create some more of these wooden works movements. Terry hooks up with these two gentlemen, whose last name is Porter, although they're not at all related. They were merchants out of Waterbury. And they say, if you can make 4,000 movements in 3 years, then we'll pay for all of your factory. So in the first year, Terry and Seth Thomas and Silas Hoadley, they figure out how to make the machinery. And by the second year, they've made about 1,000. And by the third year, they've made all 4,000 of them. And they're trying to take the different aspects of mass production. They're using some water power to run their machinery to make the parts. They're using some unskilled labor and teaching them how to create the parts. And so this is the early stages of the American system of manufacture that really brought on the Industrial Revolution. And the great thing about this is that these parts are interchangeable. So each piece is exactly the same as the piece that was produced before. So it makes the clock movements incredibly more affordable for people because there are so many of them that are being able to be produced all at one time.
Now, I think for people to truly understand how significant this was, they have to wrap their heads around the fact that each one had to be handmade. You had foot pedals that you would use to power the machinery that would help you with this. It was time consuming. It was laborious. And what he was able to do was to use a water wheel powered saw to say, here, we're just going to saw these things in wood. And this was a huge breakthrough. And because he could mass produce them and make them all the same, that's what made them interchangeable. Do I have that right?
Correct. Multiples of them are cut all at one time on a gear cutting machine that he's created. You know, all of the different spokes of the gears are cut at the same time. They're all the same height. They're all the same width. And then they can just be replaced in and out of the clocks because, of course, they're wood. So they're susceptible to changes because of temperature or water or things like that. Humidity, they would all affect, you know, the functionality of the gears and how they lasted. So to be able to change them in and out if something broke just made a huge difference. You didn't have to buy an entirely new clock. You just bought a new part.
They had people who had to paint the faces for the clocks. They had to have people who were making bells for the clocks. Tell me about some of the supplies that went into clocks.
For tall clocks, you had people who were doing dial painting. You had people who were casting the hands for the clocks. You had, as you said, bells for the chimes. You had like cottage industries of people who would be, if you had a clock that had a mirror glass in it, that was pretty specialized with people who would be cutting and producing mirror glass. And that was very expensive for a period of time. People doing etchings. Later on, you had things like the spring industry when clocks became spring driven as opposed to weight driven. You also had the screw industries and things like that that literally held the parts together. And all of this really starts in this area as a result of the clock industry.
I read somewhere that I think the year 1850 or thereabouts, the city of Bristol's work population, roughly two-thirds of them were either working directly in the industry or supplying the industry. Is that correct?
That is. Bristol itself, in its history, has had over 280 different sub-industries, if you want to call them, involved in clock making. And that's just in one city. It's a lot of manpower and womanpower going into the production of timepieces. These clocks went all across the country. They went all across the world. You know, Bristol clock making was very well known.
It dawned on me that Eli Terry did for clocks sort of what Henry Ford did for automobiles, made them more affordable by mass production. Is that something that's an accurate statement?
I would say so, because his idea was to be able to kind of bring these clocks into the affordability for everyone's house. After Terry creates these 4,000 tall clock movements, he takes a little bit of time off. I think he had a well-deserved vacation there for a little while. And then he comes back with the idea of basically creating a clock in a box, or what we would think of as a shelf clock now, because he wanted to make these timepieces more affordable to the general public. And he creates this, what really was a clock in a box. Tall clocks are weight-driven. And he had to figure out how to compensate for the lack of the drop for the pendulum and the long waits that a tall clock would have, how to fit that into a shelf clock size. So he figures that out in about 1816. And these shelf clocks then become marketed throughout what was the country at the time, really going down south, particularly out west a little bit, through using the Yankee peddler system. And so they are sold to farmers and to in these burgeoning cities and things like that. Just the idea of getting this technology out to people, much like Ford, you know, making these cars affordable and desirable, I think, is part of it too. You have to want to have this clock. You want to have this clock on your shelf. You want to be the first person of your friends to have this clock on your shelf, right? And that was where the Yankee peddlers came in. They were consummate salespeople going up and down the country.
Well, they were really sort of the precursor to the traveling salesman concept.
Absolutely. And because they didn't only sell clocks too. They would, you know, have clocks in their carts, but they would bring other things around, especially if you're going to some of the more rural areas. there's not a store or a, you know, a city center or something like that, or a town center to have all these stores early on. So your purchasing came through these traveling Yankee peddlers. You could see what was up and coming. You see these new clocks. You want to be the first person to have one of these. Let me leave this with you for a little while and see what you think about it. When I come back in a couple of months, we'll talk about paying for it. You know, and by that time, it's great. You know, you have this clock. You've gotten used to having it there. You're the first person among the people you know to have it. And why wouldn't you want to keep it?
When you think about the whole industry that Eli Terry spawned, it's remarkable that it was a couple of years after his death that the Waterbury Clock Company gets incorporated. Now, it had been around, but it becomes incorporated. And the story behind this company is fabulous because people don't understand it morphed into becoming Timex. A lot of people don't know that story. Could you tell us that story?
After Terry, once he figures out the idea of the shelf clock, the next step was to figure out how to make a brass movement. Brass was more expensive, but it was so much more durable than the wooden movements that had been used. So the next step was to figure out how to make an affordable brass movement for a shelf clock. And of course, Waterbury is the brass center of this area. Also on rivers, to be able to use the water power in similar ways as they were using it to make clock movements, and being able to stamp out the brass movements made them more affordable. You didn't have to have solid pieces of brass. You could have stamped out gears for the clocks. So the Waterbury Clock Company starts in Waterbury. They went through several incarnations making clocks, then coming into making watches as country was changing and people were traveling more. They make smaller clocks, they make watches. They're very famous for what's called the dollar watch, which was literally a pocket watch that was, again, to be mass produced and mass marketed. You want to make it to be about a dollar so it's affordable to everyone. And they were mass producing and churning out millions of these dollar watches. The company fell on hard times, and actually Mickey Mouse is one of the things that helped save the company. They contracted to be the producer of the Mickey Mouse watch that we think of now in the 1930s, and that really helped save the company and bring it back from financial hardships.
Well, the Timex Corporation is now a foreign-owned company, but the U.S. corporate headquarters do remain in Middlebury, and that, of course, keeps the connection together with the historically significant region of Plymouth and Bristol. Now, as for Plymouth, two of its villages were renamed in honor of the famous clockmakers who lived and worked there, and you've probably heard their names, Terryville and Thomaston. Wraps up this episode of Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path. Now, if you happen to have a Seth Thomas clock hanging around, it's not necessarily an original. The nameplate is still used in manufacturing today, and the only way to know for sure is to get a certified appraiser. But if you do have an original, congratulations, because you own a very valuable timepiece. I want to thank our guest for today's program, Patty Philippon. She's the executive director of the American Clock and Watch Museum in Bristol, and you should definitely pay that place a visit. The answer to this week's trivia question, the question was, some monumental global decisions have been made at a structure in Washington, D.C., a structure that Connecticut played a critical role in developing. And what was that structure? Well, the answer, a little bit of a twist on this, the Resolute Desk. Yes, it's the desk where the President of the United States sits and does their business. What was Connecticut's critical role in the development of the desk? Well, you're going to hear that full story next week. Amazing Tales from Off and On Connecticut's Beaten Path is a production of True North Associates, LLC. This is Mike Allen. Be safe and stay healthy.